morning to everybody. We'll be starting class in just about a minute or two. Resuming today with Koheles, Ecclesiastes. We're in the middle of chapter 2. We'll start just in about a minute or two. JHS, Netherlands, thanks for the audio confirmation. And again, we'll be picking up from where we left off a few weeks ago. We were doing Koheles. We just digressed to just, which I felt were important areas in the weekly parsha that we were reading. But then we'll resume with Koheles today. And we're in chapter 2. They're pretty much still at the beginning. Thank you. morning.
Morning. Is everybody still there?
Yeah, is that Josh?
Yeah,
it's
Josh.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Got Naomi and Rivka on also.
Okay, great.
Is that the rabbi?
Yep.
Oh, good morning, Rabbi. Shavuot Tov.
Had
a little technical difficulty here, but figured it out, so.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's...
Yeah, I didn't get on earlier.
Yeah. So we're gonna go back to Kehelis today. And pick up where we left off.
Naomi wasn't here last weekend, and she was asking about what we did last week, and I thought maybe you might want to just enlighten her about it. If we did last week.
Thanks. I can listen to it on the... It's online, so...
Okay.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Okay. So we were back in Kehelis, chapter 2, was where we left off. And we were talking about how King Solomon was experimenting with different type of lifestyles in order to see what would really bring the greatest happiness to a person, and was using himself as the subject of the experiment. And he tried different emotions individually, and he really showed and exposed how just joking and partying, that type of attitude, they have their limits and their problems. Indulgence in wine. And then he thought that maybe he would do a joint approach, meaning trying things individually did not prove to be successful. So then he thought, perhaps, let's try and be involved in a multiple emotions, or in a number of involvements, and see if that now is a good thing, if that will produce happiness. All right, he says that in 2:3. And he says that he's going to seize on to all of them. According to Rashi, he went further to explore his heart and to seize on to all of them, meaning all the different involvements. With what? With drinking, and with wisdom, and with just gaiety. So perhaps the reason why he didn't have happiness the first time around is he was being very objective. Is that perhaps each one individually, if a person just involves himself in one attitude and ignores others, maybe that's not a good thing. So let me see if I can be involved in all of them, if that would do anything. So, and then he says in that verse, in chapter 2, verse 3, and he'll seize on to foolishness as well, meaning in a combination with everything else, until I see which is the good way for man to live under the heavens and the limited days of his life. Now this we didn't pick up on last time, but when he says the limited days of his life, the number of days of his life, what he's doing is he's bringing a new concept. And that new concept is that man assumes, and this is what every fantasy has as a backdrop, the foundation, the cornerstone of every fantasy, is the assumption that the fantasy will be endless. So the sense of immortality that man has is something which is not examined, but by one of the wisest men in the world, of course, he does see that. And he shows us here in the verse that this is going to be an inherent problem, because what a person is looking for with his fantasies is an endless type of enjoyment. The person, when he fantasizes, does not project an end in that fantasy to whatever it is he's fantasizing about. So he hints to it here by saying that man has a limited days. So there's going to be an inherent contradiction in terms of seeking out man's fantasies, when in fact man is not going to be here forever. And that realization if he thinks about it, that will take a lot of the wind out of his sails and hopefully redirect them to the right attitude. So that's what the one word does at the end of chapter 2, verse 3. Okay? Now, what does he say he's going to do at this point? He's going to, in verse 4, we went through this a couple of weeks ago, but we didn't really take it apart. We gave an overview. So in verse 4, now he says, Higdalti Ma'asai, I'm going to increase my actions. I'm going to create houses. And this is very significant. And I'm also going to plant vineyards. But why is the first thing the houses? So perhaps that's really in contrast to what he just ended in the previous verse about having a limited amount of time on earth. A person creates a house and a big mansion. So these things far outlive the person's stay on earth. So it's a foolish endeavor that he spends so much time and money on something which the usage is really not something he partakes of, because the house stays longer than he stays. So he talks about this as being one of the first things he gets involved in. Sforno says on this, that doesn't mean that I'm going to increase my actions, meaning I'm going to increase my activities more than what's befitting me. So typically a person will labor for what is the quantity of labor will match what he projects, what he assesses is going to be the usage. A person would be foolish if he knows that he's going to work a tremendous amount, but he will not get paid. Meaning to say that the labor is not going to benefit him, somebody else gets the money. That would be a foolish thing. Similarly, if a person invests a lot of energies into labor which outlives him, or he puts together a whole bunch of money in his life, but he doesn't get to use it, so it's a waste. But he still does this here. King Solomon says, let's explore that. This is an assumption that people have. So now he's trying to address these false assumptions that the rest of the nation, the rest of the people have. He'll use himself as an experiment. Maybe there is something to it. Maybe if I do involve myself in having such a tremendous amount, that will do something to afford some happiness. Even though on the surface it would seem to be that since I'm not partaking of it, I'm not going to ever use it. Maybe just the having. See, that's what he says. I will investigate that area. I will increase on my actions, and I created houses and vineyards. So in terms of the one aspect of life, the person where he lives, so that caters to one emotion. He said, he tried that. Then he goes on and he says in verse 5, I made for myself gardens, and I planted trees of all types of fruit. Okay, what more is he doing with that? Let's take a look.
And those are things that have to do with food.
Right. So meaning to say that, it's not... The person doesn't have a sustenance solely from fruits. I mean, it could be an element of aesthetics or management of the land. There's a certain reality. I mean, this is something which is a real, it's a real staple in terms of a person's existence is his relationship to the land. So. There are certain fundamental areas that you see that he was tapping into in terms of where a person derives a certain sense of satisfaction. So his home is one thing. Having land which produces is another thing, because a person, of course, needs food, like you're saying, Josh. But more general, it's that is a fundamental in terms of a person's sense of well-being, is that he has continued... fruits that are coming from the land. A person that doesn't own any land is completely dependent. So there's an independence that's produced over here in terms of having land and having all types, meaning I was not limited he's saying in terms of any type of tree.
How can King Solomon use himself as the gauge in, like, well, I mean, just in general, but I mean, even more specifically in this situation, because he, in the first place, is not dependent since he's very wealthy.
Well, he can examine the emotions that are at work. That he can do. He's no different than any other human being because he has the same emotions as anybody else. So now let me see what type of a sensation this affords me psychologically. Does it really do anything for me? These are assumptions that people have. So now what he's doing is, okay, this is what the world, these are the assumptions that people have. Let's test the waters. Let's really see if they're true. Because this was really the whole aim.
Rabbi, could I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. His feelings of having property and having the sustenance, he's in a different level. Somebody who doesn't have anything and then suddenly has something would feel elated. Oh, now I have. Whereas King Solomon, he had, and he was already feeling, I'm going to use the word secure, he felt secure in his possession to some extent. Could he evaluate what I would feel, what somebody else would think?
Well, that's what Naomi's asking, and I'm saying there's the same question Naomi's asking.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She has a very good point.
Yeah, so the answer.
What do you think, Rabbi? Do you think that's a good point?
Yes, yeah, a good question, but the answer is.
How do we know that? How can we find that out?
Yeah, it's a good question, but the answer is that he was wise enough to separate the effects of his kingship on the emotions, and he was able to look at the emotions regardless of the fact that he was a king and had wealth before this.
Okay.
Right? Like, just like a doctor.
He was able to separate.
Yeah, it's like a doctor who may be very much in tune with a lot of medications, but still when he goes into an experiment, he'll still be purely objective and look at what happens. So he can examine the actual physical results of the experiment regardless of the fact that it's been done before. And if he had knowledge before, he looks at it right now. You can look at it factually and see exactly. So here, King Solomon is wealthy. He was able to use himself as a subject, regardless of his previous wealth or success. All right?
He could be objective. Okay. Very good.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Naomi, we're good?
Well, I want to say there's a lot of people that have all these experiences and they perceive themselves to be happy.
They perceive themselves to be happy?
Yeah, like if you ask them, you know, are you happy? And they're not doing any learning, you know. And I spoke to somebody who his whole happiness is like going to restaurants and trying new wines and stuff like that. And, yeah, he said, like, he's happy with all that.
Yeah, he might be happy as he enjoys... He might be happy as he's enjoying the meal. As he's enjoying the meal, and he's happy, and he's... there's a certain satisfaction. There's definitely, you know, the palate is definitely gets pleasure. But you have to make sure you separate pleasure from happiness. Pleasure means the physical sensation while the act is going on. Now, if there's only a certain amount of food that a person can eat, then he's in pain if he eats too much, more than that. So you have to realize that as well. And what a person tells you, don't think that that's the truth. Okay, that's mistake number one. A person doesn't want to admit that he is dissatisfied with certain things. And perhaps that's why a person constantly goes to the restaurants, because he's not really finding the satisfaction. So he tries another restaurant, he tries another one. And it's very temporary.
I think that's a good point, Rabbi. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, number one, don't trust what people tell you. Number two, think about it yourself. You'll see that there's a very limited amount that can be there. But, I mean, listen, if it's done properly, a person can definitely enjoy a meal with friends and he's discussing ideas, and, you know, the food can complement the company, and just the different parts of the personality can be addressed as long as it's done, you know, it's done in modesty, it's done properly, but a person has to realize also that he shouldn't be looking for the ultimate happiness in this one act. So that's another problem. People feel that, this is now going to do it. See, that's, I think, a very important rule we really never mentioned. and that is that people feel that this is now going to be the thing that now resolves my happiness in life, this one action. But it's impossible, because an event, an action, by definition, is limited in its scope of time. And since the enjoyment the person is looking for is physical, so when he's done with that physical activity, how can he think that it's going to linger and it's going to give anything more? That's what we said the explanation was in chapter 2, verse 2. When he talked about the comparison of joking around, he says that's one thing, and that just really is mixed with being upset. That's why I have to make it like a quick, instantaneous joke to try to suppress a certain amount of dissatisfaction in life. But then he says, to being joyful, what does this do? Meaning, if I get together and I have a joyful evening, but it doesn't do anything in the long run. You have to fill in the blank. What do you mean, what does it do? What does it do in terms of accomplishment? Accomplishment means now there's a permanent change in my life. That's what the definition of accomplishment is. Accomplishment doesn't mean that I had a meal and now it's gone. That doesn't accomplish anything. Where is the permanent change, the permanent improvement in your life? So you see that he says that, he says that openly right there. But that's what a person...
You know what, I just had a thought, and I think that most of the people that will say that they're happy because they're engaging in having, you know, fancy dining, I think that part of it is a fantasy, that they see themselves as these, like, you know, sophisticated people, and there's a whole fantasy, and I think the King Solomon, the difference is that he's not involved in any fantasy, so...
Right, he's looking at...
And if a person... No, I mean, if he's happy with a fantasy, then eventually he's not, you know, the fantasy is going to disappear, and he's not going to have happiness.
Because it's temporary, right.
Right.
It's not lasting.
And that's exactly what he says in verse 3. The limited days of man's life, you see, he introduces that so a person keeps focused on that. But you see, it is a tendency for a person to make a mistake and look for happiness in a certain thing, when really happiness has to come from an approach where all the different aspects of your personality are being addressed properly. So it's not an individual action right now that's going to now make it a change in my life for the good, for the better. All right? That's an important thing. That's what he does with how, you know, chapter 2 unfolds, is that he's talking about the different aspects. So houses is one thing. Where a person lives, that sense of permanence. So I'll make a good one. I'll make many, right? He says, I built many houses, and I planted many vineyards. It's not just one. And even beautiful gardens and so on. Meaning to beautify it, so the aesthetic appeal was there too. And again, he's now addressing the unspoken thoughts of the people, that they feel if they have this X, Y, and Z, that will bring happiness. So he says, fine, let's test it out and let's see what it really affords. And let's see if I just like, for example, when it says that we mentioned already that the Higdalti. I greatly increased. So is that going to do anything? Meaning, if I have an unlimited amount, maybe the quantity of the possessions, the quantity of my involvements, a person feels perhaps that, and that's what he says later on. You see, in verse 10, everything that my eyes asked, I did not hold back anything. Hello? Maybe you should put on mute. I'm hearing a back. Okay. So he says, anything which I, my eyes desired, right? I did not hold back anything, or anything that my heart wanted. So you see that he, what was that for? That was because to address another misnomer. People feel that, well, I'm never really getting happy because there's always a limit to what I can get. So let's say you take away that. Take away the limit. You have endless money. You have endless possessions. Now, let's see if that's really true. And he says no. And he says the only thing which he really was happy with was the labor, meaning when he was involved in the process, we said last time. He says, for my heart was happy in all of my work, and this was my portion of all my work. So in terms of the pursuit, so then there's a certain energy that's going outward of the self, and there's there's a certain amount of toil, and there's there is a certain amount of satisfaction because the need for accomplishment is in man. The only thing is, what happens after he's done doing the act of accomplishment? Now, that's verse 11. We'll come back. I know we jumped ahead a bit, but we're on this topic. 11 says, now, after he's done building whatever he was building, or hoarding up, or piling up whatever it was he was attempting to accumulate, then he reflects after all that accumulation is over. And he says, and now I reflected on all of my actions that I did, that my hands performed, and all of the toil that I labored to do, and behold, it was all futile and a vexation of spirit. Because now when it's over, so now the energies aren't flowing into the act of accomplishment anymore, which had a temporary satisfaction. But now what happens? You always come to the end of the labor. Now what happens? Now when you reflect, and now you look at the self, so now he's saying, when I go back to the attitude that most people have, and they look at their self, and it's a self-image that they carry around, and people are constantly reflecting on the self. Where am I now in life? What is my status now in life? That reflection and looking at the self, and whatever the estimation is, you can't get happiness just by looking and reflecting on yourself. Because what is that? How long could you do that for? How long could you reflect on yourself and think about the house that you have, or think about the possessions you have? Now what? A person has too much energy to just do that for longer than a few moments. And he says that is a vexation of spirit because it doesn't satisfy. So then he now says all that work that I did was worthless. Because in terms of what I thought it was going to do, it was now going to increase my self-image. Because you see, he says in the beginning of 11, and I turned and I reflected on all of my work. Meaning now it's a reflection on the self-image. Now where am I at any different? Am I any different than I was before I did all these years of work? No. And you see, he says it was a real vexation. And he concludes that verse by saying, it's a vexation of spirit, and there was no real benefit under the sun. Under the sun, again, is his way of saying the limited days of man's life. So that, as the backdrop, is always spoiling man's plans here on earth. Because, you know, it comes to an end. So how could you have satisfaction in something temporary? Okay? So I think that really brings out the point. Well, let me just stop here and see if there's any questions or comments. Okay, so let's move on. All right. So you see, he talks about, now we're back in verse, chapter 2, verse 6. Now he talks about...
Yes, I have to thank you first, because that's the key. You unlocked it. That hits on it right there. You unlock it, and that is the key. The backdrop of what was it all for? Nothing is going to change. It's still the basics, which is a man's mortality. That's it.
Right.
Thank you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing. It clarifies it so beautifully. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so what does he do further now? Let's see if we can get more of the fundamentals. So far we talked about that he built homes. All right, that's a very important thing in terms of man's sense of satisfaction. Also having land and trees, fruits. And now he moves on to 7. 2:7. He says, I acquired men servants and maid servants, and household members, and also much cattle, and sheep, and flock, more than all that had before me in Jerusalem. Now you notice here, he ends off by saying more than all those that were before me in Jerusalem. He doesn't say that in the earlier ones. Why?
You're talking about, you know, the number of possessions and that kind of thing. It's always something that's compared to what other people have.
Well, what about houses and vineyards and trees? and the brooks of water, he even says. All right, we actually skipped that one. Six says that he made the brooks of water, and Rashi says he brought in many types of fish.
But that's
maybe to have like a competitive desire.
Okay, say that again, Nomi.
Maybe to satisfy a competitive desire.
Okay, why is there competition in verse 7 dealing with servants, maidservants? And it's not competitive in terms of when you talk about houses and vineyards and the beautiful orchards and then brooks of water that he built. Why is there no competition there?
Yes, I don't know. I was talking about the other phrase, more than anyone else had.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm asking, why is that phrase only in verse 7?
I think the houses and the controlling the land for to provide sustenance and that kind of thing is more of a personal security type issue, and it's not really not necessarily thinking about competition with others there. It's more of a personal thing.
Well, I think the answer is in terms of what the object was that he was now amassing in all these different cases. The object that he was now amassing in verse 7 is people. So when the actual activity is in terms of having people underneath him, so now that's a discussion dealing with you as opposed to other people. So that brings out the issue of comparing one person to another. So here, he had all these servants underneath him. These are people, right? Even though it talks about flock as well. But now, since the element that he was now bringing in and he was making others subservient to him, so that now addresses to it. It wakes up the concept of the competition between him and other people. That he was even greater than previous kings. So not only was he great in his own time and that everybody was subject to him, but now that traversed time and it even addressed that it gave his satisfaction, or he was targeting that type of satisfaction. He was addressing that people do look for that in life. When they have a lot of servants and all, it's because of the competitive emotion with other human beings. But it's not only those who now you're superior to. Now, look, I had so many more people, that makes me superior to other people, other kings that were before me. So there's two areas of domination of men. One is in terms of hiring a lot of maidservants and members of the household, and I'm pushing around all these people. It's a tremendous thing. But it also allows the person to fantasize that, look, I'm greater than other people that were my peers, meaning the other kings, I'm even better than them. Because you might think that just by having a lot of people, fine, I'm having a lot of servants, but I'm still a king and there are other kings. So that doesn't allow the full expression in terms of I'm the greatest man. But how do you get to the full expression that I am the greatest man? If I'm not only better than people now, but I'm better than all kings that were before me. You see? So that's not brought up when he's talking about houses and vineyards and gardens, but it's brought up when he's talking about people, domination of man. Right, another fundamental in terms of the psychological assumptions of where happiness comes from.
It's the ego again, correct?
Right, but it's ego, not in terms of
ego.
It's ego in terms of competition. We have to be specific. Human competition.
Competition, okay. But this is all in the attempt of feeling better than the next one. All in the attempt of seeing that, I've accomplished more, I'm better than, but then the reality hits, and it doesn't last. It's so limited.
Well, we'll have to see.
That's the bottom line.
Right.
It really doesn't matter. So what? It's all temporary.
Right.
At some point, all this ends.
Right, but there has to be a certain happy path in life. So that's what he's exploring.
Yeah, right.
Right. He says that later on about, but let's see what he says in terms of what it was his, because he doesn't really give a response in this verse. All we can do is look at the verse and see what he was attempting to do, and then we'll have to examine what his response is.
Right, exactly. Yeah, doesn't happen so much later, right?
Right. He actually, in the next verse, it seems to me he continues a bit with this thing. He says, I gathered in much silver and gold and the treasures of kings. So the treasures of kings, again, is now about people. It's comparison. But other kings, right? That's plural. And I made many officers and female officers. So again, there's people are given out in terms of rank. So one thing is to have servants, and to have people of your household that you're directing. But now that when you're talking about officers, and you're above officers, that's even more. And all pleasures of man, v'tanugas b'nei adam. Let's see what he says on that. He says, the pleasures of the sons of man and great chariots. Let's see what he says about... That's an interesting phrase. Let's just see here. That is verse... 8. Give me one second. Servants, servants. He actually says, Rashi says it's not servants or officers. He says it's musical instruments, and shida v'shidos are beautiful chariots or wagons. Okay, so that's not talking about people, according to Rashi. He's talking about gold and silver and wealth, indications of supreme power. That's what chariots are. I guess musical instruments would be used. They do that a lot with kings, where they have other world leaders that come, so they make a big parade, and music is all part of it in order to try to elaborate, to emphasize, reach all the senses. But when he says, the pleasures of sons of man, just want to see how he has it. Let's see, take a look at Targum. Different altogether. He says that the musical instruments were for the Levites to play music when they brought sacrifices in the temple. That's interesting. see anything on. It's an interesting phrase. Pleasures of the sons of men. But the plain text means that he increased his wealth. Right, he gathered together a lot of silver and gold and the treasures of kings. I mean, would there be that type, would there be the satisfaction? Of course, money is another thing. I mean, you have houses was the first thing, and fields and orchards is another. And then power over people with so many servants is another. But then, of course, money is another fundamental in terms of where a person thinks. It's one of the most primary where a person feels he's going to be happy. So you see, he's really tapping in to all the main areas, those few main areas that people always fantasize about, that if they had it, then they'd definitely be happy. So they always think about the nice homes, you know, a nice car. You see here he talks about chariots, according to one view. You know, having land, so you have the security, having plenty of money, that's the silver and gold. So it's those are the main four that people really, so you see how he worked categorically. He didn't just try any type of a whim. He went right to what most people, or if not all people, share this view. This is where happiness will come from objects. And what are those objects? They're your home. They're your fields, your land, right? If you have a lot of land, you have your domination of man in the form of servants and plenty of money. And if I had that, I'd be happy. See, then he takes those apart one by one. And he says in verse 9, then I became greater and I increased from all those that were before me in Jerusalem. However, my wisdom stayed with me. So this we spoke about. And we said that you see that there was the element of he surpassed everybody. So that was trying to teach you a lesson that he was better than anybody else. And he was more, he had greater success than anybody that preceded him. To let you know that don't think that I'm not a good example, that maybe somebody else had surpassed me. And if maybe he really was happy. No, King Solomon was telling you, I surpassed everybody else. So you should be looking at me and the results that I'm showing you, and you don't have, there is no response anymore. Because if I increased more than anybody else, and still I didn't find the happiness that everybody projects that they would find with physical possessions and all these type of values, so then the happiness is not something which is from this area. And that's what he says. He says that I increased over everybody else that was before me in Jerusalem, and he, this was the greatest. You should know that Jerusalem at that time, King Solomon, was the greatest kingdom in the world. The wealthiest and most renowned. And that's why he says in Jerusalem, meaning there was no other country that was any greater. So I was in the greatest country and I had the greatest amount of successes. And what happened? My wisdom stayed with me. Meaning that trying to cater to these emotions, these psychological projections, is not going to make you happy, because there's a part, the essential part of you, your intelligence, is not being addressed. That's what it means, that my wisdom stayed with me. Right? And I didn't hold back from anything. That's the next verse, where he said, I didn't hold that back from anything that my eyes asked, or anything that my heart desired, from any happiness. I mean, there was nothing restrained whatsoever. But since the intelligence was not being addressed, therefore, it didn't offer that satisfaction. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yeah, I keep feeling that that's such an important point, and I go back to my childhood when my father, was still alive, and he knew somebody who had great wealth. Had it, you could say he had it all, but he had no happiness because he had a child who was very ill. So with all his money, all his wealth, all his connections, all his servants, he couldn't buy happiness. Right. The basics were not being addressed, that his inner peace was not being addressed. And it that stayed with me. Could you put this in the same category? Would that be something that King Solomon is trying to point out to us?
Well, no, that's
the real happiness is from within.
That's a different point. That's a different point than when you have certain negativities in life, it's going to have an effect. We're just looking about, you know, the playing field being, you know, fair and no real disappointments in life. Now let's take a look and examine the different assumptions of pursuits that people have. What you're bringing up is a different point altogether. We're here, this is discussing just in terms of the assumptions that people have. So are these assumptions true? So that's what he is dismantling. He's not talking about...
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Okay. All right. So that brings us to where we went through verses 10 and 11. So... Right, so remember, we'll end it here for today, and we'll pick up. We talked about 11 also, and maybe let's review it. I don't want to miss any points over here because you know, we don't know we're going to come back and do this again. So why don't we all review what we did today, pick up from here next Sunday. And we'll go further. We start talking about a new approach. And I think that verse 12 starts a new approach. All right. Any questions before we go?
Yeah, we got it. Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay. Interesting insights. Yeah, we didn't see this a lot of these things last time.
Yes, that's actually a question I've had, you know, like, why does he go into, you know, all the details of the different things? Why doesn't he just say, you know, he amassed everything that he desired, you know, but that answers the question, you know, it's different categories of things.
Exactly, and they're the primary categories. The primary areas that people assume is really going to give them so much happiness. All right, good. Okay, Laura Washington, my pleasure. Okay, Rivka Matzi, my pleasure.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you.
So we'll, if you want to look forward now, so now we're up to verse 12, you know, review what we did, but look from 12 and forward. Now let's see what's the next turn that King Solomon takes in terms of the examination. But you see, when he's talking about all these things, he's addressing the unspoken rules that people make for themselves. They feel these are truisms. So it's important to understand, why is he addressing this? There must be something which is an assumption that people have. So we keep that in mind. We have to, you know, ask ourselves the questions as he's going through it. Why is he addressing this? No, the order and take apart the categories. And then also we have to be clear as to, it's very important to see with where he makes a new move. That's why I'm saying, if you take a look at 12, you'll see why I'm saying that he's now moving on to a new area. So you have to take the different sections, analyze them by themselves. Otherwise, if you include too much, you try to analyze, so then you're not going to get the rule that he's pointing to. So it's very important that when you do
it... Could you repeat what number we're going to pick up on next week?
Yeah, 212.
Okay, that's where it goes down. Thank you. Okay. Very good.
All righty then. All right, so everybody have a great week. And we'll post this one shortly online. I think I still have to post the one from last week, so I'll post both of those. give me like a half an hour, okay? And this way you'll be able to listen to last week's too. All right, so everybody
have a good week. Good week, Rabbi.
Okay, you too, Josh. And have a good week, everybody.
Yeah, good week. Thank you, Rabbi. Be well. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.